This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Davy Arch grew up on a subsistence farm in western North Carolina. His grandfather taught him how to hunt and fish and how to identify medicinal plants. It was all part of his heritage as a Cherokee Indian. And from a young age, he was also keenly aware that to be Native American is to have two identities, Native and American. In the tourist areas of downtown Cherokee, he would see members of the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Nation wearing stereotypical Native costumes that were not at all part of his people's tradition. At home, Davy learned about the true cultural traditions from his relatives. Today, Davy Arch is a master artist with work on display at the Smithsonian. He is also a practitioner of traditional medicine, a historian, and a storyteller. And he has spent his life working to preserve Cherokee culture. Davy Arch is my guest today. Welcome to the program, Davy.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I want to learn more about your art and all the stuff that's on display around this nation. But tell us about growing up with your family in Cherokee.
Growing up was a great experience. I've had a huge extended family, and I was raised basically in the Baptist church. And outside of that, at home, I heard of a lot of the traditional stories from my grandparents and people that would come to visit. And there was always a house full of people, and we cooked and heated with wood, carried water from a spring. And it was a very different lifestyle from what people experience today, and changed very quickly. By the time I was 10 years old, we moved into a modern house, and things really began to change with the whole community evolving into a lot of what it is nowadays.
Well, tell us about the farm. What did you grow?
Well, we grew a lot of the vegetables that we ate on a daily basis. A lot of the things we grew in the garden were preserved by canning and drying. And in season, we ate a lot of wild food, a lot of wild greens and mushrooms. And in the summer, we ate a lot of fish and birds. And in the wintertime, we ate a lot of red meat. My family always were fishermen and hunters, and so we supplemented our diet with a lot of things out of the mountains. And we had the basic vegetable garden. We raised tobacco as a cash crop, and that was a lot of hard work, and that's probably why I've never smoked. I had to work too much in a tobacco patch.
And you learned a lot of that from family members, hunting and fishing. Tell us how those traditions are passed down.
Well, there was always a lot of reverence toward the game that we were taking, and there was always a proper way to clean the game after we had killed or caught the animals or fish. And if you were clean from the beginning, then it was clean when you got it to the pot or the pan and onto your plate. So the attitude of taking care of that resource was also very important to us. We knew that if we overfished or overharvested, that resource wouldn't be there the next time that we needed it. So there was kind of an ecological-minded aspect to everything that we did.
Yeah, and as you say, it was kind of built into the training, right? So, tell me more about that. Yeah,
it was. We learned a lot of things just by casual contact. You didn't have like a classroom setting or anything like that you could rely on to go back to. It was just that people grew up that way and knew how to do things, and it was expected of you to do it in the proper way. So those kind of expectations from the people that you had respect for and admired really caused it to be an important part of your life.
And very much a division of labor between men and women. Everybody had separate roles. Is that right?
That's true. There was a lot of things that everyone did, but there were certain aspects of life that were gender-specific and age-related. As you grew, you worked into jobs that were a little more important or a little more dangerous. And we cooked and heated with wood, so I use that as an example of how things would change as you got older. Tool use and wood lure and being able to do the more dangerous jobs around the house would usually fall to the older children. And the older ones were really, in a lot of ways, responsible for the younger ones. So everybody had their role to play, and the education of a child was very rounded. And in traditional times, a lot of the education of a child was left up to the aunts and the uncles and the grandparents, and it made for more or less bias education, I should say.
Less bias. Why do you say that?
A parent will treat their child different from other children a lot of times, but an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent treats everybody the same.
So you get that upbringing, and again, you talked about some of the traditions that were passed down, but you also talk about being raised in a Baptist household that would have been a custom and a cultural artifact that came from the Europeans. How consciously aware were you of being Cherokee and how much those traditions were something that you were learning?
Well, I had the best of both lives. My grandmother was very strict. We lived with my mom's parents until I was 10 years old in an extended family, and she was very strict at home. She didn't allow any cussing, card playing, drinking, or anything at her house, and we minded our manners and stayed clean. And on the other hand, her husband, my grandfather, made moonshine most of his life and was very traditional, and I was in the woods and on the creek banks a lot with him. And so it was a very different lifestyle when I was away from the house with him than it was when I was at home with my grandmother. And the women in our culture were the heads of clan and heads of household. So a lot of times important decision-making was a big part of the contribution that women made to the family. So it was...
But for your part, you had to learn to navigate those two worlds, I would guess, the Baptist world.
I did, but early on, I don't ever remember not being aware of both lifestyles. And I am Christian, but I do practice traditional spirituality. In my mind, it's the same creator.
Well,
so it's easy for us to look at things that way.
And that creator, that same creator that you talk about, is certainly part of and comes down to you through a storytelling tradition. And I know that that's very important to you, storytelling. Were you able to distinguish the kind of storytelling that passes on traditions, that passes on perhaps traditional stories like a creation myth, from just family stories and that sort of thing? Was there a moment at which you say, aha, this is the story of that all of our people share versus, you know, family lore? Was it bracketed off in the way the story was told?
Not necessarily. I think that we kind of mixed a lot of the stories and culture. A lot of the really old cultures of the world have the basic same story about creation, the world being covered with water and everything existing. What we call the Sky Arch was a place where everything lived with a creator. And they claim early on that different animals and birds and insects were sent to Earth trying to find a place to live. And the water beetle was successful in coming to Earth and diving into the water that covered the Earth at the time and brought up mud from the bottom, and that mud grew into the continents. And so that was our creation story. And after the Earth was created, then other animals were sent here trying to find a place to live, and they claimed that the great vulture, Shuliegwa, came and flew all the way around the Earth, and when he got to Cherokee country, he was so tired that his wings started striking the earth, and where his wings hit the earth, it created these valleys here in the southern Appalachians. And when he pulled his wings back up out of the mud, it created the mountains. And that's why there's so many mountains in Cherokee country.
Well, give us the bigger picture. This would have been a story shared by the larger Cherokee community. You've given us a sense of what your home was like and that farm. What about the larger community and your relationship to that?
Well, we really had a lot of influence from the federal government when I was growing up. Our school was operated by the federal government. We had a hospital that was operated by the federal government. And we have a federal agency located on tribal land in Cherokee. And so some of the rules that we lived by was kind of handed down from the federal government. And our tribe is a sovereign nation. So we have a government-to-government relationship with the county, the state, and the federal government. So some of the things that we did were regulated on that level. The other things that I can remember were the elders in our community being well-respected, and a lot of times they were the ones that we would seek advice from in planning different events. And when development started coming into Cherokee, I know that we would have regular meetings at the community centers where a lot of times the elders, along with the council members and the chiefs, would meet and really try to get a public opinion from everybody. And a lot of times young people were allowed to speak just like the elders were. We believe that some of the gifts from the Creator were presented to our culture through our children. So we listen to our children as well as the elders.
What about that? Because when those changes happened and development started to change, particularly with the casinos, but even before that, that had to be some wrenching times because of the promise, but also the challenges that were inherent in those possibilities. What were those debates like?
Well, something that popped into my mind was the debate over the Blue Ridge Parkway coming into Cherokee. At the time, the community was almost totally agricultural, and people were depending on a tobacco patch and a few logs to make a living. And there weren't a whole lot of jobs at the time, regular, what I call regular jobs. And so some of the people who were making a living off the agriculture felt that the introduction of something like the Blue Ridge Parkway in the tourist industry would really cause a traumatic change for a lot of families in the community. And so there was huge debates over issues like that. And at the same time, other people realized that there would be inevitable change and were willing to embrace the new developments and changes and would try to plan for it. So there was a pretty broad spectrum of attitudes in the community at all times about what was going on.
We'll talk about more about those debates and what went on in Cherokee country with Davey Arch, a Cherokee historian and storyteller, on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today with Davey Arch, a master artist with work in the Smithsonian Museum. He's also dedicated his life to protecting and promoting the culture of the Cherokee community. Before the break, we were talking about some of the changes that have come up in your part of the world over the years. And about when you were 10 years old, things really started to change in Cherokee. Talk about some of those changes.
Well, I can remember that there were several different government programs that the tribe hosted to bring, in some cases, electricity to communities. And the community where I lived, they brought plumbing to most of the houses, which was really something that a lot of people appreciated. I love a hot shower and an indoor commode. But things like that really changed quickly. And television hit the scene about the same time, and a lot of people were able to start buying things like televisions. Transportation changed. The roads were developed, and a lot of people were able to buy automobiles and get personal transportation, where before a lot of people walked where they went or would have to hire a taxi to take them. And about the same time, public transportation came to town, and the tribe started providing buses for public transportation around the communities. So things changed quickly, and we assimilated right into mainstream America fairly fast. My youngest brother is 10 years younger than I am, and by the time he was born, we'd moved into a modern house, and so he'd never really experienced the kind of lifestyle that I did early on.
Some of the other changes, though, included encouraging tourism, and one of the ways they did that was by creating that theme park called Frontierland. Tell us about the impact of Frontierland.
Frontierland was great for me because we lived right next door to the theme park, and the town was very seasonal at the time, so it was like having a summer-long carnival right there in the back door. It had a steam engine that would deliver people up into the theme park, where there was a Wild West town, an old cavalry fort, and an Indian village. But the village was teepees with a dance platform where they performed Western-style, powwow-style dancing. But to me, that was really great because I knew the true Cherokee culture, and I could use that as entertainment. And I got to meet a lot of movie stars that would come and be hosted by the theme park. And so it was a lot of fun for me. Some people didn't like it at all because it was looked at in a negative light compared to our traditional culture. They were purist in the way they thought about who we were as Cherokee. And so some people didn't really appreciate the idea of having a summer-long carnival in Cherokee every summer.
Well, it does present an interesting tension, because on the one hand, I'm sure that the images that were presented of Native Americans were probably cultures that were far west of Cherokee culture, but those seen most frequently in the Hollywood version of Indians. So that's what the thing you have to – if you're going to invite people to see Indians, you got to see, you know, the Sioux and the Cree or that sort of thing. On the other hand, it's your right to make a living using anything you want. So if you want to sell artifacts that were, you know, Sioux-like moccasins made in China, why not? And who has the right to tell you not to make a living? Was that part of the tension up there?
It was, and because the theme park and the commercialism provided some income for families. Most people were willing to embrace the commercialism and the tourist industry, and still today it's a lot that way. And we kind of have a way of keeping what is sacred and what is pure Cherokee out of the commercialism so that it won't be corrupted. We still have traditional ceremonies that are performed annually, usually in relationship to planting and harvesting and the phases of the moon. And we speak our language. We still use traditional medicine. And we still tell a lot of the stories. And today we even have a school in Cherokee that only teaches in the Cherokee language. We have a language academy. And so children from a very young age are taught only in the Cherokee language. So we're working hard to preserve our culture in a pure sense of what it is, and the sacred objects and sacred ceremonies are still a big part of everyday life for most Cherokee.
Does it have an impact on people who did come later and who may not have grown up in the conditions that you did in that small farmhouse with a lot of people and going out and hunting and fishing and all of that sort of thing? If they come along and half a generation later or a generation later and the representations they see of Native Americans are not their own people?
It did have an impact. Like I said, we assimilated fairly quick into mainstream American culture. And a lot of the people found it easier to live that American lifestyle than to live the traditional Cherokee lifestyle. It was much easier to go to the hospital for medicine than to go to the mountains and find the medicine or to seek out a traditional doctor. And so the attitude did change. And we see it all over America today, though, from generation to generation, the quality of the traditions are fading, and it is work, and it is something that you have to focus on to be able to preserve the integrity of these things.
Is it because for you, I think, certainly in the early part of your life, and as you became a woodworker and a carver, deeply integrated, and so it seems to me that from what I've seen of your work and from what I've heard you say about it, the spirituality, the culture, and the customs are a part of your art. They're deeply integrated, and it's a living tradition. You still make these masks and other artifacts. Is there a point at which preserving culture is about creating museum pieces and it stops being a living culture?
There is a difference. For a long time, I supported myself entirely with my artwork, and I would focus on what would mark it and what wouldn't. So even though I was producing traditional art forms, a lot of times I would try to relate that to what the collector was wanting or what the person who would be buying the object would want for their collections. And it does impact the art form in a lot of ways. But sometimes someone will need an object that will never be sold and sometimes even destroyed after it's been used. So there's still a sense of purity when I create those objects unrelated to the commercialism.
You've also allowed yourself to create objects that may not have been used in traditional or have traditional functions but seeing that as part of the evolving art, that's something that in a living tradition, clan masks, for instance, that you would have created that may not have been part of the tradition that you've allowed yourself to do because it's a living culture.
That's true. Our clans are still an important part of the culture. The women are the heads of clan, and you're always born into your mother's clan, and you're not allowed to marry within your own clan. So this is something that we recognize on an everyday basis in our community. And the Klan masks were commissioned by the tribal government for the tribal council house. And I think the first man that ever made a set of Klan masks may have been a man named June Welch. But they were very popular with our own people and with the collectors. So in my life, I've made quite a few sets of masks that represent our clans. And from artist to artist, they'll be represented in a different way. They'll be painted different and be carved with different expressions. And so there's not a single way to represent the Klan through a traditional art form like a carved wooden dance mask.
What about the older forms, the masks that have come down to you through a tradition? What were the uses? What are the uses for those masks?
Sometimes a mask would be used to identify the dance. Our dances are prayers, either asking the Creator for something or thanking the Creator for something. For instance, the bear dance was a dance we would do before a hunt, asking for success during the hunt. If the hunt was successful and we got a bear and all the hunters returned to the village safely, then we would do the dance again in thanksgiving for the success and resource of the bear.
And also, in other ways, the mask can be used as a kind of a disguise, perhaps to remind the dancer that this is in the name of the tribe and not the individual, to disguise the identity of the individual from the god.
That's true. And sometimes a mask would change identity from dance to dance, and it would be used as a disguise because you wouldn't want the spectators involving the identity of the dancer and what they were praying for, basically. And it's still a big part of the culture. And today we have annual ceremonies that center around the, like I said earlier, the planting and harvesting and the phases of the moon. We live under a 13-phase calendar because of the way the moon cycles off.
Given the importance of the mask in these rituals and dances and their critical kind of mediating role between the people and God, how is the tradition passed down? I mean, is this passed down? Can anybody learn it, or does this get passed down through clans and through particular families?
A lot of times the leaders in the community that are considered sacred people, we call the men beloved men and the women beloved women. And a lot of times these people are responsible for conducting the ceremonies and adhering to the medicine involved with the ceremonies. And they're responsible for kind of keeping the rules pure that are passed down to the younger generations. And a lot of times you'll hear one of these people doing the singing. The dance songs are passed down from generation to generation. And once in a while, we will develop new dances and new prayers. For instance, one of my favorite dances is the horse dance that we developed after the introduction of the horse from the Europeans. We loved horses and we loved guns. And so these things are represented in our dances nowadays.
Yeah, and that's an important thing to understand. You know, in the 10,000 years or so that natives have been on this continent, that those changes had to have taken place over that period of time, just because circumstances would have changed. So you would imagine the introduction of new dances, new ceremonies, maybe the elimination of some older ones.
That's true, and sometimes the dances would occur whenever they were necessary. For instance, if someone's house burned or there was a catastrophic disease affecting the community, we would develop dances to deal with that. During the smallpox epidemics, hornet nests were used as masks a lot of times, and as the dancers would perform the prayer, they would tear that mask off of their face, representing how the smallpox was affecting our bodies. So we were using traditional forms of prayer in a contemporary sense.
That also brings us to the gathering of medicinal plants. Did you learn that? How did you learn that? And what use is it still being used today?
Yes, very much so. A lot of people still practice what's considered holistic medicine or herb medicine. And there are doctors who still practice the conjuring or supernatural aspects of the medicine. And I've been taught to respect the plants and the resource. A lot of times if I go to gather medicine, I'll wait till I find the fourth or the seventh plant. And a lot of times if there's a lot of the same plant in the same area, I'll stand back and watch the plants And usually there'll be one that will be doing something different that will cause me to recognize it as the plant that I'm supposed to harvest.
This suggests long periods of deep, radical watching and listening in the woods, time I suppose you spent in part with your grandfather?
Yes, he was very good about teaching me things like that. And he had a different name for a lot of the plants than what you'll find in a biology book. And some of these were translated from Cherokee words, and other times he would have a word that would explain how it was being used. And a rule of thumb in our culture is that the outside of the plant is used to treat the outside of the body, and the roots in the inside of the plant is used to treat the inside of your body. And if you clean your blood will clean your body.
And gender is important, but medicine is used differently for men and women. Is that right?
It is. There's gender-specific medicine just because women and childbirth and those kind of things are totally separate from what a man would experience in his lifetime. And traditionally, the doctors would be born into the medicine and go through ceremonies with the older doctors. And we have a great story about this separation of the medicine because of gender. They claim that a young doctor was going to meet with the older doctors, and sometimes some of the medicine can only be talked about after dark, and some medicine can only be talked about in the daylight. And he was going learning about the after dark medicine, and his wife couldn't stand to think that she was being excluded from these meetings. And so one night she slipped out and disguised herself with a panther skin and snuck up on the doctors, and they caught her. And because of her disrespect for the men's medicine, they condemned her to roam these mountains for eternity as what my grandpa called a wampus cat. They turned her into a panther, and they claimed that she can turn back into a woman, but when she's hungry and needs to eat, she has to turn back into that panther. Mm. Sometimes I'd be with my grandfather back in the mountains, and we would hear a panther, and he'd say, "Listen, it must be awful painful for that old woman to change back into that cat." Said she's probably seeing you and looking at you as her next meal. He'd have me scared to death sometimes. I'd look over my shoulder all day long after hearing something like that.
Well, you also had an experience with this kind of medicine because of your trouble with nosebleeds as a young man, right?
That's true. When I was young, my nose bled a lot. Like I would be asleep and wake up with my nose bleeding, or I could be playing in the yard with the rest of the children and my nose would start bleeding. My grandfather took me to an old doctor, and it was really an interesting thing. We had no telephones or no transportation at the time, and he took me to Robbinsville, about 40-50 miles from Cherokee, and hired a taxi to take us down there. And when we got to the doctor's house, everyone in the house was out at the woodshed away from the house. The doctor had cleaned out a room in his house of everything except for two chairs and a glass of water. He'd taken the pictures off the walls, the curtains off the windows, and he took me into the house and made my grandfather and the taxi driver stay out the woodshed with everyone else. And he would sing for a while, and then he would talk for a little while. He was doing all this in the Cherokee language, and once in a while he'd take a sip of water and blow a mist over me. And I was 7 or 8 years old, and it seemed like an eternity to me. It seemed like we'd stayed in there forever. It may have been a half hour or so, but when he got through with what he was doing inside, he took me back out to my grandfather and told my grandfather to shoot a bullet where he could retrieve that bullet, and to crease it with an axe and crimp it on a string like a fishing sinker and tie that string around my neck close enough that I couldn't slide it over my head, and instructed me to wear that bullet until the string broke. And I wore that bullet for about a year and had intended to keep the bullet as a memento of the whole ceremony, but I was swimming in the river when the string broke, and I lost that bullet in the river. And I'm not sure, but I believe the bullet represented killing the problem that was causing my nose to bleed. And after we left that man's house, unless I got hit in the nose or something like that, my nose quit bleeding.
What do you make of that story? You're a man who's fully assimilated in Western culture. You are also deeply committed to preserving Cherokee culture. What do you make of that story?
I think a lot of our medicine is faith-based. I knew in my heart that that man was going to fix me when he took me through that ceremony. And I worked with an old man who taught me how to carve masks that was a traditional doctor, and he said that we've taught ourselves not to believe. And that was one of my grandfather's favorite sayings, is that we've taught ourselves not to believe. And today in our modern culture, we have to prove everything with science and have proof of everything. But the old guys just knew in their heart that these things were going to be, and they were.
The good news is that science is now coming to the conclusion that what's in the heart has a lot to do with what's in the brain, and they're communicating all the time. And the more we learn about that, the more we will come to perhaps a deeper understanding of what you just described. I want to hear more, so we're going to continue our conversation with Davy Arch. He's a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee and a master artist and storyteller, and we will hear more on the state of things in just a few moments. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Davy Arch, a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Nation, and a man who's dedicated his life to preserving the traditional culture of his community. We're talking about your childhood skills and what you learned from your family. When you graduated from high school, you considered going to college, but instead you worked at the Okanalufti Indian Village. Can you tell us more about that?
This is a recreated village that represents the middle 1700s and a lot of the lifeways that were being practiced by the Cherokee at that time. We had started to assimilate somewhat. We had metal tools and guns and things like that, but in a lot of situations, the culture was still very pure from what it had been thousands of years ago. And it was a great learning experience for me. Some of the people that worked there when I first started as a teenager had helped build the village and mostly used the Cherokee language as a first language. Both my parents had worked there when I was younger, and so I'd been around the village quite a bit in my lifetime, and I was offered an opportunity to work year-round there at the village. And so in the summertime, I would work as an artist and a guide explaining the traditions to the tourists that were coming through. And in the wintertime, I would help conserve the buildings and do some of the maintenance work around. And the guys that I worked with were steeped in tradition, and I always had stories to tell, real-life adventure stories as well as the traditional legends. And it was a great place to kind of hone some of the skills that I'd been practicing already, the wood carving and arrowhead making and basketry. And I love clay. Pottery was a big part of the village scene, and we had some master artists that were working the different stations where we demonstrated these arts. And early on, I took it on myself to just go to these people and start a project so that they would help me understand where they were coming from in producing this kind of artwork that related our true traditions to the public that was coming through Cherokee.
How far along were you in, say, the art of mask making when you got there? Because I know you'd been doing woodworking most of your life, but was it mask making as well? And how much did you learn at that village?
Well, I'd never made a mask before I started working at the village. A man named Sim Jessan was working as a wood carver at the wood carving station there in the village. And a couple days a week, I would sit with him on station. And I was making dough bowls and spoons and utilitarian objects that I was able to give for Christmas presents and market in the shops around town, and carving a lot of small effigies of birds and animals. And once in a while, I would carve a little statue or something that might have a face on it. And when I asked Sim if he would teach me how to make masks, he suggested that I make a collection of small masks that would represent the larger full-size masks. He said, you won't put so much time into the project that you'll get burnt out on it, and you'll learn to carve the features of a face by doing that. So I still have the collection of the first six or seven little masks that I made when he was teaching me how to do this. And he used just a few simple hand tools, and he was a master at dyeing and painting and coloring the masks that he made so that they would be highlighted into whatever they were going to be used for. And he would use things that people wouldn't necessarily look at as something to decorate the mask with. He would use things like shoe polish and magic markers and house paint and fur from different kinds of animals and feathers from different kinds of domestic birds, and so it was a real learning experience. And he was a traditional doctor, and so a lot of times he would relate the medicine involved in the project while he was making something. That was really enlightening for me.
What about the wood? Is that important? And wood gathering? How do you find the wood you want for the mask you need?
Now, today I use a lot of buckeye, which is a light, soft wood. And buckeye and poplar were traditional woods that were used in the carving of wooden masks. And before the introduction of metal by the Europeans, we had wooden masks, but a lot of times they weren't as elaborate as the masks that we began to carve after we got metal. Metal tools just made it so much easier to work wood. We still make masks out of gourds and bark and furs and all those kind of things like they were made from traditionally. But the buckeye and the poplar were soft and readily available. I have made them out of chestnut and cherry and black walnut and exotic woods, but I still use buckeye most of the time when I make a mask. And I rarely ever have to cut a tree to get my carving wood. There's always a power line right away or a road development or something that where they're cutting trees down, and usually I can find carving wood in the scrap piles. And so I rarely ever have to actually go out in the woods and cut a tree down to get the material that I need.
And I know you tell stories, and one story in particular, about the importance of those masks in your culture. Can you tell us that story?
Well, the stories that the masks relate to are different. A lot like the story a while ago about the hornet nest mask and the smallpox epidemics. Now, I have used masks in dances. One of the masks that comes to mind is a mask that I used in a dance during the first Gulf War when we were praying for help against what was going on over in the Middle East. And when I came onto the dance ground, I was named Scud for the Scud missiles that we were having to deal with, like the North Koreans are launching nowadays. But these masks have extreme importance in relating the idea of what the prayer's about to the spectators and to the dancers themselves.
But I wonder about the marriage of these two cultures and the way in which they come together and can assimilate and cannot. I'm reminded of a story that was once told about a Central American native meeting a missionary, and the missionary was talking on and on, and the native was talking about dreams and the importance of dreams and the leaders who used to have dreams that would guide the people. And the missionary asked, well, so what about now? What about your dreams? And he said, oh, our dreams have no power here anymore since you came here. A clear suggestion that what works and what was absolutely essential to a people, when that tradition changes and when there's a new dominant culture, the intersection is not so smooth, that they don't seem to work together. Do you find a way in which these two can actually assimilate, that a dance like that can have power in a culture like this?
It has tremendous power in helping the people who are involved in the event, as well as helping us to socialize and relate to what is going on a more intimate level. And in these ways, we're able to assimilate as well as preserve. And there's a lot of times and a lot of funny stories about how the dominant culture has used things that we considered sacred. For instance, Sim, the man that taught me how to make masks, used to use the example of the eagle. We considered the eagle a sacred bird and believed it could fly high enough to relate the prayers from earth to the Creator in the sky arch. He said it was sacred until he started putting it on money.
So, well, there's also, I guess, tobacco, too, which would be the great revenge of the native peoples.
That's true. That was always considered a sacred plant and a sacred medicine. Now it's used, as something that's really not as healthy as it should be or once was.
it's deadly these days because of the way it's used. You've earned the title Master Carver for your abilities. What does it mean to you, and what does it mean to be a Master Carver?
I can make anything. And over the years, being able to produce high-quality work that is viewed on the fine art level as well as the folk art level has caused me to be recognized as a master carver. And I've done things as large as 50-foot dugout canoes and things as small as a grain of rice. Mm. And so there's a broad spectrum in my ability to create whatever I'm wanting to at the time. And I understand the materials and the tools, the finishes, and can relate that to students so that I can teach as well as produce.
You've also worked, and you mentioned your interest in pottery and the significance of pottery in the Cherokee culture. Can you talk about some of the symbolism that we might see if we were to see some of those pots?
Well, today we've revived a lot of the old traditional Cherokee pottery techniques. For a while there, we had begun to produce pottery for the tourist industry, and the old style of cook pots and utilitarian ware was something that wasn't being produced as often. And there was an effort to recreate and preserve some of these traditions by developing a potter's guild in Cherokee through the Museum of the Cherokee. And Joel Queen and I were two of the men that were involved with this. Most potters are women in our culture. And we were able to carve paddles that would be used to impress patterns onto the clay while the pots are still pliable. And some of the symbolism related in the traditional patterns relate to, for instance, if you see a pattern going in a counterclockwise circle on a vessel, that is relating to the upper world. If you see a pattern going in a clockwise circle, that's relating to the underworld. We believed in three levels of existence: the underworld, the world that we live in, and the upper world. And so these things would be related to by patterns and designs that were created in a lot of our artwork, really.
I'm interested in something you said earlier about the fact that when you first began doing masks, your teacher said, well, start with some small ones. You'll spend less time. I take that point, but then I hear you say that you've done pieces as small as a grain of rice. And my thought is, well, isn't it harder to do the miniatures because the details are that much finer and tougher on your hands and wrist, I guess?
They are, and today as I age and a little bit of arthritis sitting in it, it gets to be harder and harder to create those small objects. And I used to do a lot of miniatures, and my eyesight and the ability to hold my tools and focus like I used to is becoming more difficult all the time. And I don't produce near as much as I used to, but the things that I produce today, I really strive on creating in the highest quality possible.
You also practice archaeology and work in that, but that is a change for you because you used to be pretty much opposed to archaeology in your part of the country. Tell us about your transition.
Yeah, when I was growing up, I looked at archaeologists as a bunch of grave robbers digging up my ancestors and didn't really have a very high opinion of the whole science. But I became involved with archaeology as liaison for the tribe in repatriating some burials and was able to get into the science of it. And today, we rarely ever have to dig up a burial because we know what's in the burials. We can use technology to X-ray the ground, and so there's no need to disturb the burials. And our people were placed in the grave in a ceremony to be left there for eternity, the remains anyway. So my attitude has really changed in the last 20 or 30 years toward archaeology, and today we're able to retrieve information from archaeology that really helps us understand our older culture and helps the general public to understand who we are as a culture. And I love making arrowheads and doing what I call the pre-Columbian arts. And one of my favorite stories about Flint is that it was all contained in the body of a giant. And that giant lived in Cherokee country. And everyone was afraid of the giant, but they knew that life would be a lot better if they had some flint. They could make fire and weapons and tools. And one day, this was in a time when everything could talk to everything else. And one day the rabbit said, I could probably get some flint. I'm not afraid of that giant. So everybody challenged him to do so. So he came up with a plan to feed the giant until he got full and went to sleep. And he had made him a hammer and wedge and intended to knock a chip off the giant's body. But he fed the giant to the point that he gorged himself. And when the rabbit snuck up on the sleeping giant and struck him with the wedge, the giant exploded, went all over the universe. And today you can find flint on every continent of the earth. And it didn't kill the rabbit. It split his upper lip, and he still carries that scar today, and cut his tail off, too. That's why a rabbit's got a short tail. And you can look up at night, and what people call shooting stars going across the sky are actually pieces of that giant's body still circling the universe.
It's a wonderful story, and it talks about the very origins of the Cherokee people and some of the first moments in their development. The latter moments, of course, include gambling casinos and fast food, and I wonder about life in Cherokee country today, today and in the future. How do you see things going?
Well, today, because we are making some money off of the gambling, we have some political clout, which has really been an asset to us as a people and culture. The drawbacks, it's always a double-edged sword. The fast food and the modern living has taken its toll on us as a people concerning our health. Diabetes is a plague in Cherokee, and today, because of the way we live and the fast food restaurants and the commercialism, making it so much easier to live off of that than to garden and to eat properly and in a traditional way, it's impacted every family in our tribe. And everybody in my family's diabetic except for me. And so it's a real problem.
Do you see a way through that? Is there a way in which some of the benefits of this kind of living can also turn things around?
Well, we're making enough money today that we can afford to have programs that will educate the young and help combat these issues that we were kind of nonchalant about when they first started to impact our community. In the last couple of generations, we've seen the ill effects of some of this. And so today, we're really striving hard to go back to some of the traditional aspects of living, teaching our language, teaching our culture, teaching our medicine. And so I'm really optimistic that we will come out of this. And we've been here through all kinds of adversity, and so I'm sure the Creator has a reason for us to be here still. So, like I say, I'm optimistic we'll survive into the future as a pure Cherokee culture.
Davy Arch, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Davy Arch is a master artist with work on display at the Smithsonian, also a historian and a storyteller, and we have links to his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.